We are talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And another fine week that I know you are both very excited to report on the developments of.
Oh, yeah.
So starting out.
I posted a COVID update this morning, and it's way worse than you think. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how bad you think it is, it's way worse than you think.
Yeah, I don't think the mainstream media really is keeping a whole lot of tabs. It's almost like they're running around in denial a little bit of how bad it is here in particular.
Yeah. Yep.
In the United States.
Yeah, and the local Puget Sound coverage has not been good either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll be getting to that in just a bit. When we get done with the show, if people need further depression. So let's start out. The city council was very busy this week.
Yes, they were. The Seattle City Council was going through all of the amendments for the 2021 city budget in the budget committee and voting one by one on the amendments, although Teresa Mosqueda had grouped them into three packages. Package A, which included amendments that have broad consensus. Package B, which were new amendments that she thought would have broad consensus. And Package C, new amendments that she was pretty sure wouldn't have broad consensus. You can guess whose amendments made up Package C, mostly Shama Sawant's. And amendments that she's brought up before that didn't gain another co-sponsor or other support from other city council members were mostly put back into Package C. So these 2 days were days when city council members could revive amendments that Mosqueda had not included in the balancing package the week before and try to get other city council members to support them. And those are the ones that Shama Sawant brought up that were mostly put into Package C. Now, Package A, again, contains most of the amendments that we've talked about in previous weeks, including amendments for additional money for things like climate policy, food access, and health services. Over $72 million for BIPOC communities and participatory budgeting, money for housing and homelessness services and for hygiene services, and additional funds for transportation projects, including bike lanes, transit corridors, and urban trails. Package A also included cuts to and transfers from the Seattle Police Department that total about 20% of the Seattle Police Department's budget. Most of that involves transferring the 911 call center, parking enforcement, emergency management, and mental health officers out of the Seattle Police Department into new departments. And that those total transfers amounted to about 17% of the SPD budget. Now, the rest of the cuts, that other 2-3%, involve harvesting smaller cuts to things like travel and training programs that can't be done because nobody's traveling because of COVID-19. Cuts to things like equipment purchases, removing funding for vacant positions that the SPD hasn't been able to fill, cuts to overtime pay, and requesting that the Seattle Police Department lay off 35 officers who have the highest number of infractions or disciplinary decisions against them. And I think it's interesting to note that the Seattle Police Department had reported to the city council and the mayor that a number of officers have already left the department and that a lot of them are officers with disciplinary decisions against them. So there's a little bit of that already going on.
Those folks can still get jobs in other departments.
Oh, yes.
Nothing in state law that prohibits that, unfortunately.
Yeah, and a number of them have probably moved on to other police departments in Western Washington. Now, the council voted not to continue Mayor Durkan's 2020 hiring freeze into 2021. Sawant had proposed that in an amendment that's in Package C, but it only gained the support of one other council member, Tammy Morales, and both Lisa Herbold and Lorena Gonzalez spoke against it. Now, what hasn't been covered much by the media, I think, are the six Seattle Police Department amendments in Package A that don't involve money, but that require the Seattle Police Department to give more information to the council about its operations. You can call these the reporting amendments. And they point to what the city council is going to be looking at in 2021 for future cuts or for savings when they do the 2022 to 23 biannual budget next October. I want people to kind of understand that the city council clearly sees this as a multi-year process. It's not a one and done thing like the mainstream media has been portraying it. Oh, you know, the city council members committed to cutting the police department 50%. They're going to gut the department, blah, blah, blah. That's not what they're doing. You know, they're making cuts where they see that they can make, where they can do it easily. And then they're asking for a lot more information so that next year they can look for other easy cuts that they can make. And here's a quick summary of what those six reporting amendments are. They require monthly financial reports for the Seattle Police Department as a whole starting on January 1st of 2021. And that's the city council's, you know, please tell us what's in that big black box of a budget that you have there. They require monthly reports on excess pay starting on January 31st, 2021. They require a report on which duties performed by sworn officers could be turned into civilian functions. That's due January 1st. They want to know what incentives the city could provide to increase early retirement for SPD officers. That's also due January 1st. They want monthly reports on use of overtime starting January 20th, and two reports on how the Seattle Police Department is implementing the city auditor's recommendations on changes to overtime hours and special events. Those two reports are due May 1st and August 1st. Now, this amendment includes very specific requirements for these reports, including lists of which officers and units work the most overtime, and the status of a new system for tracking work scheduling and timekeeping that was supposed to have been implemented a couple years ago, but's been put on the back burner by the Seattle Police Department, which currently tracks overtime with handwritten slips rather than a computer-based time tracking system. And of course, there are other details in that amendment as well. It's a very good amendment, I think, that will help the city council figure out exactly who's getting paid for what in the Seattle Police Department. They also require monthly reports on overall staffing levels by precincts, including the demographics of new hires and people leaving the department. That starts January 20th. So every month, they'll get reports on that. The amendments require two reports on traffic stops, including the demographics of those stopped by the Seattle Police Department. The first report is due May 1st, would give just the demographic info. The second report, which is due November 1st, would include recommendations for addressing any racial disparities identified in the first report. They require a report that provides the cost breakdown of using parking enforcement staff to man special events, sporting events, and directing traffic instead of using sworn officers in the SPD. That's due March 30th. And then they require quarterly reports starting January 1st on 911 call response times for priority one calls only. So only for those calls that would require a person with a gun. And then finally, they require a report issued by April 5th on ways that the Seattle Police Department can demilitarize, including the types of weapons that the department is purchasing, the use of body armor, training programs, and an emphasis on protecting citizens over protecting property. That was an amendment introduced in Package B, I think, by Teresa Mosqueda. So Package A has a total of 125 amendments. Package B has 36 amendments, including the following. I'm just going to talk about five amendments that are in Package B. One is to add money into the Seattle Department of Transportation because Proposition 1 passed on November 3rd. That's going to fill in a big hole in the Seattle Department of Transportation budget with about $30 million of revenue next year. And there are additional amendments in Package B specifying where that money will be spent. There's also the amendment to add a $20 car tab fee for bridge maintenance, although when this was discussed, the council pulled that amendment out of Package B, discussed it quite extensively, and then removed the requirement that this fee be spent on bridge maintenance alone. Instead, there's going to be a three-month process where the council takes community input and then decides where the $20 car tab fee revenue will be spent in the Department of Transportation budget. Now, the fee is going to start mid-year next year when the old $60 car tab fee expires. So Seattle residents will see their car tab fees fall by $40 next summer rather than $60. Now, another amendment in Package B is the proviso or restrictions that the council is placing on the remaining $30 million in Mayor Durkan's slush fund for BIPOC communities. And also there's an amendment introduced by Tammy Morales for a new eight-person HOPE team to replace the navigation team. Initially, Andrew Lewis had made a proposal, and then Tammy Morales jumped in with a separate proposal, and they got together on this new eight-person team to replace the navigation team. And it's interesting, you know, when you read that amendment, your response is probably going to be the same as my response, which is, you know, why haven't we done this yet?
We're only 20 years into a homelessness crisis.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of detail in there, you know. And I'm reading each line of it thinking, geez, you know, a past mayor or human services department director should have put this in place years ago. It's just so common sense, all of these things. And, you know, with each statement, I'm thinking, do you have to spell this out? Well, apparently you do, because HSD and the mayor, our past mayors and our current mayor, just don't have the common sense to put in place something as important as, you know, let's talk to the community of service providers. Let's coordinate them, you know, on our homelessness response. Let's not treat people like they're trash. You know, let's provide as much housing as we can with the understanding that we're not going to be able to do it all in 1 year. You know, and in the meantime, while we're waiting to get housing built for these folks or shelter built for these folks, let's provide them some hygiene services, you know, and let's provide them some drug treatment and other outreach services, you know, mental health services that they obviously need. I mean, it's just so common sense. And then, of course, Package B contained other smaller amendments that I'm not going to go into that would add money for human services, housing, homelessness, and a whole lot of other departments in the city budget. Package C.
I think it will be very interesting to see whether the current leadership of the Human Services Department and the mayor's office are willing to actually spend that money. I mean, the council is obviously trying to impose its will for policies that have been both broken and seriously counterproductive for many years.
Yeah, now and, you know.
And the people who are embedded in that system are going to be resistant to constructive change. They just are. And it's really unfortunate.
Well, Erica Barnett had a great article on her blog, The C is for Crank, which you can now find at publicola.com. Where she discusses the unusually high number of provisos in the 2021 budget and the large amount of money in the budget that's covered by these provisos in comparison with prior budget years, and how that reflects the lack of trust between Mayor Durkan and the city council, especially the fact that Durkan has not been spending money that the city council has budgeted over the last over the last couple of years and has not been following the council's budget priorities. So, you know, what can the council do other than to put these provisos on a record amount of money to try to force her to spend it where they want her to spend it?
Yeah, you would think that would have some legal standing, but
we'll see.
Yeah, I don't blame them for not having a lot of trust. I don't think that they're going to miss Mayor Durkan in 2022.
No, I don't think so either. Now, Packing, as I said, included just 8 amendments that had not been discussed or co-sponsored by any other council members or had been dropped out of the balancing package by Councilmember Mosqueda. 7 of those amendments were sponsored by Shama Sawant to do things like increase the Jumpstart payroll tax to plug holes in the budget for libraries, parks, the Department of Transportation, and the Office of Housing. Another amendment to take $7 million from the emergency fund and spend it on more tiny home villages. Another amendment to continue Mayor Durkan's 2020 hiring freeze for the Seattle Police Department into 2021. An amendment to cut $151 million from the Seattle Police Department budget in order to reach that 50% defunding goal. And then to use that money for affordable housing. And an amendment to restrict the Seattle Police Department from sweeping residents of an encampment without ensuring that they have shelter or access to a space in another unsanctioned encampment. None of those amendments
didn't
passed.
Didn't that used to be the official navigation team policy?
It was, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That's what they told the city council they were doing for years. Before Mayor Durkan was elected, and she just kind of threw that out and said, "Oh, that's crazy."
so now that's a controversial proposal that failed city council.
Yeah, that Shama Sawant proposed, and no other city council member endorsed, and it didn't pass. And then there was one final amendment in Package C, an amendment by Alex Peterson to require that the New Hope team, which is going to replace the navigation team, issue quarterly reports similar to what the navigation team did. And that amendment was discussed widely by the other city council members with Shama Sawant, Tammy Morales, and Teresa Mosqueda, questioning Peterson's motives for introducing that amendment. The navigation team amendments had been in the budget because the navigation team was doing what it said it was doing, which apparently it was not, and they could see that every quarter with the quarterly reports. But this amendment passed 6-3 with only Sawant, Morales, and Mosqueda voting no. We will get quarterly reports on the New Hope team and metrics of how many people housed, et cetera.
I would think you would want that simply because, you know, the HSD and the folks administering the Hope teams are going to be the same people, right? They're going to be the same departments.
It's not clear that it's going to be exactly the same people.
Yeah, but
guess is it will be.
Still want that ballot in place. I think you would still want that check in place. I'm not sure. I mean, I understand Sawant and Morales not trusting Peterson's motives, but I would still think, the Durkan administration will be even greater at this point.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. I mean, much of the discussion was about what metrics would be in the report. So what would they be measuring?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear to me that they're going to be measuring the things you're talking about. I think what Peterson wanted them to measure was performance metrics, like how many people are getting housed, how many people are getting off the street, which only gives you a portion of the picture. It's not telling you how many people are getting drug treatment, for example, how many people are getting how many people with mental health issues are getting treated and are getting access to regular medication if they need it. So there was a lot of discussion about that. Are the metrics that are specified in the amendment the only metrics that are going to be provided or that the council would require to be provided? And in fact, they discussed that. Yeah. This budget is full of a lot of amendments, and we may not hear right away because there's a whole lot of reading there for the mayor and her budget crew to do.
So I got the impression that things that were grouped in Group C aren't don't stand a chance, currently a chance in hell of moving forward. What about the ones in B?
Well, most of the ones in B did move forward. There were a few that were dropped out, but they're not ones that I've talked about in the past, and I was kind of surprised they were added in there in the first place into Package B. And actually, if you go to the Seattle City Council Insight website, the guy who runs that website, he did a pretty good look at what those amendments that were dropped out of Package B are and the discussion that the city council had over them. So he posted something up there late on Friday that's actually a really good read if you want to know what amendments didn't make it through Package B, but most of them did.
Is that Kevin that does?
Kevin Schofield.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. He does a very good job.
He does a very good job. He's very good with legal issues in particular.
He's a serious wonk for those of us who appreciate that.
Yeah, he's more conservative than I am, but yes. I really appreciate his technical expertise when it comes to legal, particularly legal court cases and analyzing the likelihood of court cases succeeding or being overturned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's also good at looking at just general city council issues, too. And that's kind of what his website focuses on.
Yeah.
And that's Seattle City Council Insight, as well as the C is for Crank, which is Erica Barnett's blog. You can find that at publiccola.com.
All right. Both good resources.
Yeah.
Very good resources.
Okay. Anything else on Seattle City budget? Okay.
Nope.
Also, not to be outdone.
Yeah, the county council is actually a couple of weeks ahead of city council on their schedule. They passed their final budget this week, and Dow Constantine signed it into law. They don't seem to have any trust issues with Constantine. The passage was unanimous, which is notable since county council has a lot more ideological diversity than city council does. You've got progressives on the council, you've got Republicans on the council, and they came to this agreement. There were a number of notable things that were passed, particularly steps that were taken to move forward Dow Constantine's commitment to ending youth detention in the county. That got its first concrete budgetary passage this past week. There were $6 million went toward a community-created response to divert youth away from the criminal justice system and into community-based restorative justice. That's new funding for something called Restorative Community Pathways, it's a pilot program this year that will provide services to 800 young people in lieu of filing criminal charges, while building additional capacity to grow those alternatives in years to come. There were measures trying to increase the transparency of King County Sheriff's Office. And, of course, there was also the charter amendments that passed this past election in early November that made the sheriff an appointed position again rather than elected and took some other accountability steps for the sheriff's office. And then $4.2 million. Dollars of the rainy day fund is going to ensure that families and individuals who have been moved out of emergency shelters to hotel rooms in around the region because of the pandemic don't lose that housing if the Senate fails to take up any kind of COVID-related financial assistance to state and local governments by the end of the year, which they will not because the Republicans will still control
the Senate. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you dropped out at my end, or I dropped out.
Yeah, you dropped out for a minute.
Okay. So, yeah, the current COVID housing for for unhoused folks was funded dependent on future emergency forthcoming. Let's see if they do, because of course there's a special elections for the two Senate seats in Georgia in early January, but that's not by the end of the year, which is what the budget specified. So they did plug that budgetary hole. And then similar to the reports that Maria talked about for city council, the county council is requiring reports from the Constantine's office and the sheriff's office, and concrete steps moving toward ending youth detention. Constantine has laid out a 5-year timeline for that, and the county council is looking at future budgets and what they will need to do, the steps they'll need to take in 2022. But they did pass the 2021 budget, and that is now the law of the land.
Yeah, and didn't Dow Constantine commit to ending youth detention publicly?
Yes, he did. That was in early October, and he laid out a 5-year timeline for that, and that's what county council was working with.
And I think that came out of the marches that were held this summer. I remember watching the video of a march where demonstrators went to Constantine's house in West Seattle. And he basically told them, you know, and they were mostly talking to him about, you know, when are you going to end youth detention?
It can now be told that those negotiations had been going on with Constantine since May, and they were primarily led by BLM Seattle King County, that chapter, and it was hush hush for a long time. That's where the negotiations came from. They were working very closely with his office on that announcement, and with county council on the budget package as well.
Although to be fair, the efforts to work on that have been going on for years and years.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. No, the activist pressure to try and end youth detention has been going on for at least 6 or 7 years now.
Yeah.
And a lot of really good committed activists who've been working on that for years, you know, youth jail and other groups as well.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, nope. Let's move on.
Okay. Back to Seattle and Mayor Durkin and the West Seattle Bridge.
Yeah, this week Mayor Durkin announced that she is choosing to repair and not replace the West Seattle Bridge. The Seattle Department of Transportation had done a number of different options for the city council and for the mayor to look at to either repair or replace the damaged West Seattle Bridge. And really, there's only two options there. Either you replace it altogether or you fix it, right? And replace seems really attractive because you get a brand new bridge that's going to last 75 years, possibly a full 75 years instead of just 35 to 36 years that the current one has lasted. But, you know, there are some major drawbacks to doing a full replacement. First off, of course, there's the cost. SDOT estimated that it could cost from $391 million to $522 million to do what's called the rapid replacement of the main span, the central span of the bridge, which the city can't afford that all by itself.
Yes, and it especially could take, not in a pandemic.
No, and it could take over a year to get the funding allocated from the state and or federal government, possibly more than a year, 2 years or 3 years. The replacement option, on the other hand, I mean, the repair option, on the other hand, would cost between $45 to $50 million to do the repair itself. Then there's the time issue. A replacement wouldn't open until 2023 at the earliest, and possibly much longer, depending on how long it would take to get the funding, while a repair could be ready to be open by mid-2022, and a couple of lanes could possibly open earlier on the bridge. There's also the environmental impact and permitting. For a replacement, the environmental impact statement and the permitting process could both be very costly and could delay construction for years. whereas the repair option can go ahead without those constraints. Now, the downside to the repair option is threefold. First of all, we don't know if the repairs will work and for how long. Now, Seattle Department of Transportation Director Sam Zimbabwe said this week that the current stabilization of the bridge is working really well, and he thinks that the repair could also work very well. But he's estimating that it will probably only add about 15 years to the life of the bridge, not the 40 years that Mayor Durkan is hoping. So there's that to consider.
Where does Mayor Durkan get the 40 years figure from? Well, that seems wildly...
From the original lifespan of the bridge, which was supposed to be 75 years, right? Secondly.
Yeah, but it's already failed.
Exactly. Secondly, there's the continuing maintenance costs. Seattle Department of Transportation is going to have to continue to inspect the bridge on a very regular basis and to shore up the repairs, make sure that they're not failing, right? And SDOT has estimated that could double the maintenance costs on the bridge, if not be more than that. And I've seen that vary very widely on that. So nobody really knows how much money that's going to be. And then finally, we still don't know why the bridge cracked in the first place. Okay. Think about that for a second. When you don't know why the bridge cracked and has issues, you just don't know how well a repair is going to work and if it's going to last or if other parts of the bridge are vulnerable to cracking too, like the two approaches to the bridge. So that's a real downside of the repair is, you know, if we don't know why it's cracked, then we don't know whether or not a repair makes sense. Or even, you know, you could argue, well, we don't know what to replace it with if we don't know why it was damaged in the first place either. Now, reporters asked Mayor Durkan during her press conference if she was going to pursue trying to get money from the original design and construction companies that built the West Seattle Bridge. And she said, well, first we got to find out why it cracked, obviously. And then she said, I'm not foreclosing any legal options that the city might have once we figure out why it cracked. So that's coming down the road. In the meantime, Durkan is asking the Seattle Department of Transportation to begin designing a replacement right now so that the city at least has a design and we could start asking for federal funding for that sooner rather than later, especially if the repair doesn't work, right? Now, in addition, she's asking Sound Transit to consider adding bicycle and pedestrian improvements to the light rail bridge that Sound Transit will be building separately from the West Seattle Bridge as part of the West Seattle to Ballard light rail line. So I thought it was kind of interesting she brought that up in this discussion, but I think she was maybe trying to get people to think positively about this whole process.
And isn't that slated for like 2030 or something like that? It's quite a ways
there,
off still.
It's out there a ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the status of the West Seattle Bridge. I can tell you that the folks in Georgetown were hoping for maybe a better answer, some better answers to that, because they've been suffering a lot of the impact of the increased traffic, which is going across the low bridge, is being routed through Georgetown.
Yeah.
And folks living in West Seattle, of course, were probably hoping for some better news than that. But I think a lot of them are thinking, okay, good. We only have to suffer through this for another year or so, year and a half before we get our bridge reopened. We'll see how that works out.
Oh, yeah, we will.
Yeah. Let's be optimistic until we hear otherwise.
This region's history with bridges is not a positive one.
And, you know, the city only spends a few million dollars a year, about $6 to $8 million a year on bridge maintenance, when we really need to be spending over $30 million a year on bridge maintenance.
We still got bridges damaged from the earthquake 20 years ago. It's insane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's the downside of living in a city where we're right on the water, and the city's cut into several pieces by waterways, is that you got a lot of bridges, and that's a lot of money to maintain those bridges. So that's why it's really important that the city be looking at getting federal funding for some of these projects. And of course, during the Trump administration, that was not possible. During the Biden administration, it's going to take him some while. He's got a whole long to-do list once he takes office. And an infrastructure bill is not at the top of that list right now.
Yeah, and we'll be talking a lot about that and cabinet choices and all the rest over the next 6 weeks.
We will, yeah.
All right. Well, that takes us on to this week's COVID news.
Yeah. Well, locally, the news is not good. Washington State now has 140,000 confirmed cases total for the year, and only reached 100,000 about 3 weeks ago. So that tells you how quickly that rate is growing. King County is adding about 700 new cases every day, which is close to triple the peak from last spring. So it's bad. Governor Inslee announced a new round of state economic support this week for businesses and families impacted by the pandemic. Of about $135 million in that package. Included in that total was $70 million in business support grants, $30 million for the recovery loan program, $20 million for rental assistance, and another $15 million for energy bills for low-income households. The $70 million in business support grants includes $50 million for a new round of Working Washington grants focusing on the hardest hit industries by the pandemic. And the remaining funds are supposed to go to historically disadvantaged businesses who applied for earlier business grants. Inslee also this week capped restaurant delivery fees like Uber Eats and DoorDash at 15% and total fees at 18% of the purchase price of an order. Some restaurants had been adding, gouging for people who didn't want to risk going out to, pick up orders in person themselves, because it's getting bad out there. Let's see. Do you want anything, locally, Maria?
Nope. Let's move to the national.
Yeah. National is bad also. We had a whole round of new restrictions by different states, largely Republican states that have in the past, resisted those kind of, pandemic measures. If our states were each country's, North Dakota would now have the highest mortality rate of any country in the world, and South Dakota would be third. Both of those states, of course, had long resisted any kind of pandemic measures. South Dakota still has, with Kristi Noem, their governor, but North Dakota instituted a mask mandate way too late last week. The Atlantic reported this week that 22% of all hospitals in the country are looking at staffing shortages. That's because either the staff is themselves out sick or in quarantine, or because they're simply burned out because they've been working long, hard hours for weeks or months as this pandemic has crested in their areas. The state of Indiana is completely out of ICU beds at this point. Hospitalizations in the U.S. are up 50% in the last 14 days. 81,000 people hospitalized as of Thursday. You know, it just goes on and on. So, different states, Ohio imposed a statewide 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew. In Maryland, all bars, restaurants, and nightclubs were ordered closed by 10 p.m. Pennsylvania is now requiring that anybody traveling to the state needs to be tested before arrival and then quarantined for 14 days. And given that, you know, Philadelphia is right on the river with New Jersey, that's one metropolitan area that's going to play havoc in that area. Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, imposed its own stricter restrictions this week. Several school systems, including New York City, the state of Kentucky, and the city of Denver, all bailed on in-person learning. You know, the sheer geographic scope of all of these different measures. California,
rolled back its reopening plan to square one and basically shut down all the counties in Southern California, which is 20 million people. The sheer geographic scope of all this tells you that, you know, when we had the peak in last spring, you could move healthcare personnel from region to region to help alleviate staffing shortages and deal with the crest. You can't do that now. Every state except Hawaii, which also requires a 14-day quarantine for people arriving from the mainland, every other state in the United States is seeing rising cases, many of them to record levels. It's really bad. I would add to all that that we had a couple of very high profile positive tests this week of people. Donald Trump Jr. tested positive. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. And then, then 87-year-old Chuck Grassley, who is not only the most senior member of the Senate, he's also fourth in line to the presidency. The Republican senator from Iowa has tested positive. And both of those individuals have conspicuously refused to wear masks in public appearances. So, that's what happens when you don't wear a mask, right?
Well, and it wasn't just Chuck Grassley. Also, Alaskan Representative Don Young, who's the oldest member of the House of Representatives at 87 years old, same age as Chuck Grassley.
I hadn't even heard about Don Young.
Yeah, he had been hospitalized over the last weekend for COVID-19. So he's also sick. A total of 84 members of Congress have either tested positive or come in contact with someone who has and are under quarantine. The Democrats in the House have imposed a mandate for members to wear a mask when they're in attendance. And they've also instituted a proxy voting system. So if you're in quarantine, you can still vote. While the Republicans in the Senate have refused to do either of those things, they just highly recommend masks but don't require them. And they're still requiring members to be present in the chamber to cast a vote, which is not helping slow the spread of COVID-19 throughout the Capitol.
Yeah.
And actually starting to interfere with the Trump agenda, because the Senate was unable to get enough votes this week to confirm his appointee, Judy Shelton, to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors
Thank God for that.
Yeah, because she's terrible.
She was terrible, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, the White House is doing its part to spread the virus around Washington, D.C. You know, this week, yeah. Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller attended a meeting at the Pentagon, and either he or his staff passed COVID-19 on to their guest, the Lithuanian defense minister, as well as to the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense, Brigadier General Anthony Tata. Yeah.
And Miller, remember, was just appointed last week to replace Mark Esper, who Trump fired.
Right.
He's a Trump loyalist and was met with a lot of suspicion by the Pentagon brass. That didn't help.
No, that didn't help. You know, and most attendees at that meeting wore masks, except for Secretary Miller, who refused to wear a mask. He removed his, and then he couldn't resist shaking hands at least twice with the Lithuanian defense minister. So I think we know who he got it from, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in addition, Rudy Giuliani's son, Andrew, tested positive this week, along with three more White House staffers. So thank goodness that I don't want to say it's a good thing, but, you know, I think the Trump administration would be a whole lot more destructive in these last few weeks if they could be more effective and they didn't have so many people sick from COVID-19. Now, the flip side of that coin is that there could be some real emergencies that need to be addressed by the federal government and by the White House staff in particular that are not getting taken care of because so many people are sick and unable to do their jobs. So
yeah, and it's also
that's the flip side of that coin.
Yeah, and also the Trump administration's refusal to coordinate the transition with Biden's people is impairing the possibility of a rapid COVID response by an incoming administration after January 20th. Biden and his coronavirus task force folks have been complaining about that all week, that, the the petulance by Donald Trump and his administration over not recognizing the results of the election is, there's so much data to go through by the incoming administration that it's literally costing lives each day at this point that Trump does not coordinate. And that message started coming out loud and clear this week.
Yeah. And, typically too, in a transition, the federal government, provide some funding to the president-elect in order to staff his transition team, to pay salaries to the folks who are working on his transition, and to hire people for the new administration. And currently the Trump White House is refusing to provide any funding to Joseph Biden to do that. And Biden is now asking Democratic donors to donate. Please donate money so that I can pay people to help with my transition.
Yeah,
and that's unprecedented in American history.
Yeah, that should be money that your taxes are going to, but instead they're going to things like, the border wall, which is continuing to be built and tear down habitat and all the rest of that, particularly in border areas of Arizona, when it's never going to be completed. And that's one of many,
portions of it are falling into the Rio Grande River.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been
a disaster.
And that's one of many examples of, sweetheart contracts that the Trump administration has entered into with companies owned by major donors that is going to have to be investigated once there's a new regime in place. But, that's for the future. Currently, we have to get through the pandemic, and Trump seems determined to just burn everything down on his way out the door. You're seeing a lot of Republicans, particularly in Congress, and major donors and the rest of that, and in the business community, acknowledge that Trump won, that Biden won the election, and that Trump's current efforts to defy the election results are futile, at least legally speaking. It emerged this week in a Reuters report that Trump is fully intending his only strategy now, since he's something like 1-for-35 in his lawsuits. His only strategy now is to try and convince Republican state legislatures to try and overturn the election results and appoint Trump electors instead of electors that would be loyal to Biden in states that Biden won. We saw the state of Georgia go ahead and certify Biden as the winner yesterday. That's the first. Michigan
of the swing states, yeah.
Yeah, of the swing states. Michigan is scheduled to do that on Monday. They're required to certify Biden as the winner by state law. Trump invited the heads of the Republican Senate and House in Michigan to the White House yesterday to try and convince them to overturn the election results and appoint Trump loyalists instead. And the Trump's lawyers have already admitted in court multiple times that they have absolutely no evidence of fraud. They don't want to perjure themselves in court. So, under questioning from the judges, both in Pennsylvania and also in Arizona, they had to admit that, actually, we don't have any evidence of this. We do have a few hearsay things, but we can't really prove anything. No, Your Honor, we're not alleging fraud. But you can say anything on Twitter. You can say anything to the media. And that's what Trump is trying to do. And he's trying to convince his base that he's the rightful winner of the election, and a frightening number of his base believe it.
I found it heartening that when those Republicans came out of their meeting with Trump, those Michigan Republicans said, well, we didn't hear anything in the meeting that's going to make us change our minds and actually try to overturn the official results of the election, which is that Biden won Michigan by over 157,000 votes.
It wasn't close.
It was not even close.
And they had said that before the meeting as well. They were already on the record as saying, as have the Republican leaders in Pennsylvania, which are the two states that Trump would need to convince at this point to try and make up his electoral deficit. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, so this week a Nevada district court judge denied a Republican Party request to halt the certification of ballots in Nevada. The judge called it a shocking request.
Which it was.
Yeah. Which it was. And then a Wisconsin judge also rejected requests from the Trump legal team to throw out absentee ballots, including 60,000 ballots cast during in-person early voting in Dane County, which includes the city of Madison. So that didn't go very far either.
That's the most Democratic-leaning county in the state. And Milwaukee, which I think was the target of another lawsuit, they went after that too. That's the other major one. And those are also the two most ethnically diverse counties in the state.
Yeah. And then, just before Georgia certified their results this week on Tuesday, the Trump team, actually, I believe some Republicans who, support the Trump team filed a lawsuit in Georgia on Tuesday, in which they confused the states of Michigan and Minnesota in their affidavit alleging that Dominion voting systems was the target of hacking. Yeah, now the townships they named in the affidavit were supposedly examples of statistical anomalies showing that there were more votes cast than registered voters are actually not located in Michigan as they claimed. They're actually townships in Minnesota. And because of those and other errors, the judge just threw it out of court with a come on, there's no
and there was also one in Michigan where they filed it in both state and federal court, even though federal court didn't have any jurisdiction in the case.
I know.
I mean, this is not an A team of lawyers, put it that way.
Oh no. And you know, this week the New York Times reported that most of the Trump legal team's challenges to vote tallies are based on incorrect information provided by attorney Sidney Powell, who keeps confusing the company Dominion Voting Systems with another company named Smartmatic, which is actually a competitor in providing election equipment to governments. And then she somehow ropes in the deceased former president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, into her fantasy of voter fraud, right? Even though, you know, Hugo Chavez died it back in 2013, 3 years before Trump was elected.
Yeah, there's a vague connection because in 2010, Dominion had a contract for voting machines in Venezuela.
That was Smartmatic.
Oh, right. That's right.
Smartmatic. And yeah, I was going to say that. The same.
They got them completely confused. It had overlapping boards or something. It was totally bonkers.
Yeah, the only connection between Smartmatic and Dominion is that Smartmatic sold some of their assets, and then 3 years later, Dominion Voting Systems purchased those assets from a different company altogether. So there's no connection at all. And, you know, she's also sprinkled in stupid stuff like, you know, George Soros is responsible, the Clinton Foundation, Antifa, Cuba, China, blah, blah, blah.
She was interviewed last night on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox, and Carlson actually had to challenge her on her facts. And now he's getting blowback from Trump loyalists for somehow being disloyal to Trump by, you know, not going with the flow for stuff that's just utterly bonkers.
Just bonkers. And and Tucker Carlson himself.
And it's been interesting because
he thinks there was, you know, voter fraud, but he basically had to admit, look, this woman's got her claims are completely unsubstantiated, you know, and then Republican Senator Joni Ernst is on the record now, saying that she thinks Sidney Powell's, views are offensive and unreliable, you know? That's the quality of Trump's legal team right now.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens when, electoral votes get certified, whether, the Trump administration, like, acknowledges that they need to cooperate with the transition or not. That will be the next, major challenge. And then, as I, noted, Biden is starting to pick his cabinet members. He's going to announce the Secretary of State next week, I believe. So that's coming up, and then we'll see whether Trump willingly leaves office, because his legal avenues to avoiding the outcome of the election are closing quickly.
All right. Just a few minutes left. Continuing, a federal judge overturns Stephen Miller's work.
Yeah, federal judge Emmett Sullivan, which people may remember, he made a number of crucial rulings during the Mueller investigation with the D.C. Court of Appeals. He overturned the Trump administration policy of refusing and expelling children that had sought asylum in the United States.
Unaccompanied
children as quote unquote public health risks due to the pandemic. Since March 2000, March this year, 200,000 kids have been.
No, it's 200,000 people total. 13,000 of them were unaccompanied children.
Okay.
The rest were adults and families. Expelled people seeking asylum, expelled with no due process.
Yeah, and the emergency ruling by the CDC that we had a pandemic that was used for that was ruled by Judge Sullivan to not be an adequate reason to deny those folks due process. The ruling was relatively narrow; it applied only to the unaccompanied minors, not to adults who've already. Who've also been expelled, but that precedent may apply to future legal challenges that are already in the court system. So we'll see where that goes.
It's notable too that a lot of those kids have not been sent back to their countries of origin. So we're talking about unaccompanied minors being just shoved across the border into Mexico when they're not from Mexico. And their families in desperation trying to figure out, where's my child? Where's my child?
Yeah. Now, Biden has said that after the inauguration, he will revoke Trump's remain in Mexico policy that's forced, tens of thousands at least of people to be hanging out in encampments on the other side of the border, waiting in vain for, some kind of due process in terms of U.S. immigration. These are mostly asylum seekers who are legally entitled to apply for asylum in the United States, except those policies have been revoked under the Trump administration, probably illegally. They're certainly not complying with a number of court orders at this point. So that's a huge mess that Biden will have to try and untangle after he gets into office. So we'll see where that goes. But that was an important court ruling this week that kind of got buried in the news.
All right. And very quickly, it appears one of Trump's attempted parting gifts to his supporters is the announcement of sale of oil rights in Anwar.
Yeah, that was announced this week. Interestingly enough, there's not much demand at this point because oil prices are not very high because of the pandemic. That announcement was made by Trump's Interior Department this week. And, we'll see if those sales can be undone under an incoming Biden administration. Chances are good that there will be legal challenges to it, and the Biden administration will support those legal challenges. So we'll have to keep an eye on that.
All right. Okay. With that, we are out of time. Still the daily marches still continuing.
They are on Facebook, Morning March Seattle, where you can see where they gather each morning to do yoga and go on a march. And these are BLM marches, of course. And then Instagram account, Seattle Evening March, all one word. You can find out where they convene each evening about 7:30.
All right.
Dress warmly.
Yes. Layers is the key.
Yes.
For those that have that option. Okay, we will look forward to talking with you both next week.
Yes, and
yes,
happy Thanksgiving.